Okay. All right, we can start running. A lot to do. It's been quite a few days, and who knows what will be tomorrow. If anyone would tell us to write a script that there'll be national elections a few months apart, you'd say impossible, but anything goes here. Today is Monday, Baruch Hashem, the 27th of May, 2019, and I say hello to the students in front of me and to the many listening. Just a comment, I'm getting quite a few emails about where I'm speaking in the States. I don't know anything where I'm speaking. Some of it I won't even know till I get to the States. The person to contact is Rabbi David Kofnis, who lives in Teaneck and heads up the Shvut Ami office in America. He'll know what my schedule is. He'll know because he's arranging it. All right, I want to pick up here, and first of all, a correction. I didn't check it out entirely, but Rabbi Rubin called me earlier and someone told him, and it could very well be... Excuse me? Dr. Zizmor, right? He's the one who makes the correction. I was quoting something. It was not my mistake. I should have checked it out before quoting it, but generally you see something in print, you believe it. But what I quoted was that the Herbert S. Goldstein and Chief Rabbi Hertz were contemporaries in JTS. And this cannot be because Rabbi Hertz graduated in 1894, according to Dr. Zizmor, and Herbert S. Goldstein graduated 1914, so they're a full generation apart. So I want to stand corrected. Vic, Rafua Shlema, I have to... Shani Shalom, I think I'm the oldest person in the room, but I'm dancing around like a Knein Hara. Okay, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. I model LaKadosh Baruch Hu and the doctors, and you know, my Baruch Hashem, they knew what they were doing. Also, I want to mention with the demise of the great Herman Wouk, who we spoke about, I believe, last week already, and so be aware that he credits Rabbi Dr. Leo Young for being the inspiration behind This Is My God. I have the story here. It was published years and years ago in Jewish Life and republished again by the OU. And it seems that Rabbi Young, he was living in Manhattan at the time, Herman Wouk, and this before he was married. And he started going to Rabbi Young's shul, and he was enamored with Rabbi Young and became very friendly. And Rabbi Young saw this man has writing ability, and he gave him a good kick and told him to do something on Yiddishkeit. And Rabbi Young lent him his personal copy of the 19 letters of Ben Uziel. And once he got involved with the 19 letters, he saw what Rabbi Young had in mind, and the result is This Is My God. A number of sub-students sent me a beautiful story which appeared in the book I quoted to you, Memorial Encounters by Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky. Torah Mesorah was putting out, I think it's called The Jewish Parent. It was a magazine. I still remember. Maybe they still put it out. And they had a review of Herman Wouk's book in it, This Is My God. And at one of the sessions of Torah Mesorah with the Gedol Yisrael, who served as their board of rabbis, one of the so-called Gedolim got up and told off Joe Kamenetsky, and he stormed and railed, "How did you allow a review of a book by, quote, such a man, end quote, to appear in a Torah Mesorah publication?" And it's unbelievable. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, sage and peacemaker that he was, tried to quiet his esteemed colleague. "What's the gewalt? You're taking a particular passage out of context. Why, God forbid, were you to take a passage of the Chafetz Chaim out of context? You might have doubts about him too." And these sweet, gentle words by Rabbi Yaakov only infuriated this Rav, his critic, more. Well, at that moment, Rabbi Moshe stepped in. He knew Herman Wouk well. His son-in-law, Rabbi Moshe Penland Ben Wook's advisor on religious matters for the book, when my critic actually stood up to his full height and maledicted Wook and his work, Reb Moshe, who is thought of stature, stood up also, looked right into the man's eyes and cried, I want you to know that Herman Wook is as frum as you are, or perhaps even frummer. That ended the argument. So I think that's a beautiful tribute. I also want to mention my nephew made an unbelievable point. My nephew I'm talking about now, Dr. Zev Rothkopf, and I was in his office the other day, and he said to me, you just spoke in the shir about Rav Shimon Shab's great-grandson and how he committed suicide rather than reveal secrets to the Syrians who had captured him. It's a legendary story. It's a true story. The early 50s, and you can look it up. It's online. It's well-known. I still remember hearing about it in the States, although I never realized it was Rav Shimon Shab's great-grandson. So my nephew said to me, just think for a minute, Reb Shimon Shkrup, remember, Uncle Aaron, the story you told about the Maggid who went from town to town and he spoke about the Zionistische, said what they want to do, what are they out of their mind, they're going to declare war, all the Jewish youth, the Kol Mishamach Meshuach Mulchama, Mi Yisha Shabana Bayit, right, Mi Yisha Raira Rachvalei Vav. And all you're left with is the Chafetz Chaim and the Netziv and the Geder Rebbe and the Belzer Rebbe and Mitzvah and Mimachim Milchama, and everyone's laughing, including Reb Shimon. Only Reb Chaim Brisker didn't laugh when the guy came to Brisker. Reb Chaim said, "What's the Shaila? Of course we'll make Milchama and win with them." But Reb Shimon was laughing. Take a look who his great grandson became. So I thank my nephew. That's a very, very fascinating point. Okay. Let's get in and understand the heart of Herbert S. Goldstein. Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, once again, his years, 1890-1970. Here's a man born in America, born on the east side of New York. He's the only one of the big three, actually, to be born in America. Rabbi Young was not, Rabbi Lichtenstein was not. Although I have to say, in the earlier part of the 20th century, the big three were Young and Goldstein, not Rabbi Lichtenstein. He was a bit younger. It was Rabbi Drachman. They were the big three. Remember Bernard Drachman? We spoke about him, Zichron Ephraim, today Park East. But Rabbi Goldstein was born on the east side, evidently born in a well-to-do home, meaning middle class, upper middle class by New York standards. And the unique distinction, davened Beis Medrash HaGadol. By the way, a student sent me a printout of Beit Medrash HaGadol, and it is out of, it had a fire, they put money in, and again, and the building is, it's going out. The problem is that it's a building that has historic value. What do they call it? A Binyan Mishuma in Hebrew. What do they call it in English?
Landmark.
A landmark building. So it's not so simple what you can do with it and how it ultimately will be dissolved. But very fascinating, time moves on. So he davened the Beit Medrash HaGadol, and his father was a balabas there, and Harry Fisher was a balabas. And at this kid's brit milah, Harry Fisher was there, his bar mitzvah, Harry Fisher spoke, and he marries Harry Fisher's daughter, Rebecca, one of four daughters. He's the only rabbi son-in-law. They're all prominent people, the sons-in-law. But he ultimately, most of his life later, is devoted to Rabbi Harry Fischel's enterprises, his charities. Herbert Goldstein is the man who, for instance, the biggest Harry Fischel enterprise is the Harry Fischel Institute here in Israel. And it was Rabbi Goldstein who was the contact. Anyway, his early childhood, a bright kid. His mother was his father's second wife. The story is very fascinating. His father was widowed with six little children, or six children of various ages. His mother was a very frum girl, and every shidduch they proposed for her, it was typical American East Side story. The parents were frum. The man they proposed already was a Mechallel Shabbos, working on Shabbos willy-nilly, whether he liked it or not. Here, they proposed the shidduch with this widower and six children, and he was a frum man. And she took on the six children. Herbert S. Goldstein is from her own child, and she was insistent he had to get a good education. And that's what we mentioned. Never was at home with Yiddish. He was an American kid. He played baseball. He played stickball on the streets of the Lower East Side. And she insisted that he have a private Rebbe from the time he was 6 years old, so that his education basically spent one term in Eitz Chaim on the Lower East Side. But he was very unhappy because everything was in Yiddish, and Yiddish was not his native language. Interestingly enough, I found my mother, my brother's niece, does research on family. It's a sport for her, an avocation. She came up with the census in 1920 or 1930, and my mother was asked, there on each sheet, there are a few people they picked to ask more questions. My mother was asked, what was the first language you spoke? And my mother answered, Yiddish. So it shows that in Harlem, her parents spoke Yiddish to her when she was a little kid. But Herbert S. Goldstein already evidently was totally at home only in English. Then he goes on to Columbia University, and then he goes to the seminary. And that's where we left him a week ago. He's now at the seminary. He's studying. He always went out of his mind to warn you, to tell you, to stress that I might be a student at the seminary, but I also have smicha from Rabbi Yaffa. And that again raises the whole question of the private smichot. And that was the minig in America. People who went to the seminary and wanted to show they were Orthodox and knew Yoredeya, they got private smicha on the east side. Of Shalom Yaffe, who was very involved in Yeshivas Chanan, a very prominent rabbi, was a masmich. It's like here in Israel, you go to the chief rabbi or Reb Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. There are people or institutions that give smicha. Fine. Now, while he was studying at the college, he went on to high school, Townsend. We spoke about it, I think, we ended off last week, Townsend Harris High School, I checked it out. You're absolutely right. It was a very selective school. It was like Bronx High School of Science. They didn't take every student. You had to be bright, had to pass an exam. He was there, and his private teacher was Rabbi Henry Goodeman. And does that name mean anything? Yitz, do you recognize the name? Rabbi Henry Goodeman, an early Musmach of Reeds, who later was rabbi in Scranton, Pennsylvania for the rest of his life. He was the most famous rabbi ever to serve in Scranton. His son, Simon Goodeman, was dean of Yeshiva College when Yitz and I were students. Remember? And Rabbi Goodeman became part of the Goldstein family. Everyone loved him. He ate with them, and Herbert, very influential on Herbert. Here was a Reitz Musmach. Here was someone going into the rabbinate. He went to Columbia U, and in Columbia U, they had a special program. It's very similar to what's going on. Mori can tell me if I'm right or wrong. At Machon Lev, they have a high school, a feeder school. Your senior year of high school, you can already, a bright kid can start taking courses in Machon Lev. No? Right?
From the ninth grade they're taking
courses. From the ninth grade already. Wow. I know that was one of the greatest achievements of yours truly, that when I was a senior in high school already, I was in Reb Nachmanstein's shiur. And that's one of the great things of YU, that if you wanted to get ahead, they didn't look high school, college. It's up to you, your mind, what you can handle. So he's in Columbia, and the last year he has the opportunity to go to Columbia Law School. And he goes to Columbia Law School, and something happens in Columbia Law School. There are various stories, but I think we can best summarize it, that when you get involved in law, you have to face many difficult decisions. One of the most basic decisions: can you defend a person who you know is absolutely guilty? Yeah, you all know that. A guy kills his mother and father, and you have it here in Israel, Lo Aleinu, who could have a dream, but we have it. A family from Ramat, here a mother and father were killed near my grandson in that part of the city, and they arrested, again, there's nothing proven, but they arrested a Talmud Chacham with a beard who gives his shir in Maseach. And what went on here, then he was released. So who knows whether the police have seichel or don't have seichel. That's a different question. But would you defend an individual? He robbed, stole, Madoff wants you to defend Sidney Weinstein. Just now it's in the news. One of his lawyers, teaching at Harvard, I believe. Where was he teaching?
Harvard.
The students rebelled. And they had to fire him from Harvard because he took on Sidney Weinstein. No, I asked you, is it every murder, every rapist, aren't they entitled to have someone defend them? What are the students yelling, smelling? The same thing with Dershowitz. Remember, he took on O.J. Simpson. They went crazy. But, all right, Goldstein made the decision. Law is not for me. Now, what was JTS like at this time? Obviously, he's switching from Columbia. He's graduating. He's going to JTS. He's finishing up his ordination. What was JTS like? And here, the value of memoir literature. This, I've always stressed, it's fabulous because people basically don't lie. They can't make this up. And here, Herbert S. Goldstein left some scribblings about his life. His grandson, who wrote the biography, The Maverick Rabbi, I quoted it last week, I gave you the source, right? Aaron Reichel, spoke with his grandfather, and his grandfather told him, describe JTS circa 1910, 1912, 1914, and here he comes in from Columbia, and he starts studying in JTS, and there's no time slot for a mincha minyan, okay? And he started raising the roof. Those who daven mincha daven, suddenly when a class ended, they stood in back and davened. He is raising the roof, and because of him, they made a mincha, and he got the nickname Mincha Goldstein. So the famous Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, he was known as Mincha Goldstein. But more than that, Hanukkah time, they had a celebration, and they got together, New York, what did you eat? Again, it's an amazing thing. When I was a kid, this was the greatest food in the world. Today I don't go near it. Salami sandwiches, delicatessen, and he raised the roof. No one made it washed Netila Judayim. He didn't hear a Motzi Lechem. He didn't hear benching. And he was very, very upset and yelled and shouted. So much so that Solomon Schechter said to him, I like your frumkeit, but you're a bit too frum. When Harry Fischel, when the engagement came with Rebecca, Harry Fischel went to ask what kind of student to see. You've got to remember Solomon Schechter, JTS. It was not yet pronounced conservative Judaism with a large C. We'll get to it maybe, I don't know, next week or next term, whatever. But so Schechter told his father-in-law-to-be that there's only one problem with your son-in-law-to-be. He's a little too frum, a little too religious, quote, end quote. And Harry Fischel commented afterwards, that made me very happy to hear that my son-in-law-to-be was a little too frum. Now, here, look what's happening. Here's this Herbert S. Goldstein. We described him last week from Vic Geller's book. The man had a complex that he's going to make everyone frum. Remember, my class of last week was an important class. He's not going to let America rob the youth. Here he is marching with kids, we'll see later, the nickname Billy Sunday, and he's like if you imagine Steve Riskin in the 1960s, this is the comparison Vic Geller made to me, that was Herbert S. Goldstein in the 1910s. So he's preaching, he's building a reputation, and while he's at JTS, even before the nation, his first position is at Kehilat Jeshurun. So now in 1914, 1915, you have three tremendous rabbis. Each one you could write endless articles, books about in Kehilat Jeshurun. Kehilat Jeshurun is a very interesting congregation. The Upper West Side, when Jews made it very big, went up from lower middle class to middle class, went up to upper middle class, some actually wealthy millionaires, they moved to the Upper East Side. The Upper East Side always attracted a more elegant crowd than the Upper West Side. Whatever the reasons, I don't know, but that's the social reality of New York until today. You got to be wealthier to live on the Upper East Side than to live on the Upper West Side. I don't know what the reasons are. A sociologist probably could explain it. So you have a very wonderful, fancy congregation, a beautiful building. Original building, I believe, was 1902. And they brought Ramaz from Boston. Rabbi Margolis had been in Boston. The Eastern European Jews worshipped the ground he walked on, and now these wealthy balabatim brought him to New York. And Ramaz, with a giant of Torah, Yirat Shemayim, Hasidic, stories are told about him, Maasem Mofsim, as they're called, and also a slight Americanization. But he was the European Shurav of Kehilat Jeshurun. The assistant rabbi was someone slightly older than Goldstein, a JTS graduate, Mordechai Kaplan. Mordechai Kaplan is the assistant rabbi. All right, what role is there for Herbert S. Goldstein? He becomes a teacher in the Talmud Torah, and very shortly thereafter, the principal of the Talmud Torah, so that you have three rabbis. In order of seniority, of authority, Rabbi Moshe Zvulun Margolis is on top of the ballpark. Mordechai Kaplan is his assistant. And the Talmud Torah in the hands of Herbert S. Goldstein. And here an idea germinates. The world in general credits Mordechai Kaplan with being the godfather of the concept of an institutional synagogue. The truth of the matter is that two have to share the award. As far as I know, most valuable player in baseball, it's never shared. There always is one winner. Here in reality, two people working together, working under the same environment, both of them germinate the same idea. Ultimately, there is one tremendous difference, and this may account for the fact that when Charlie went to school and heard a lecture on Mordechai Kaplan, they told him that he was the founder of the concept of an institutional synagogue, the community center. The reason is very simple. The idea germinates, we'll see in a moment how, when, where. But for Mordechai Kaplan, the general facilities of the Jewish Center became as important as the synagogue and ultimately more important. Mordechai Kaplan's place later is called, anyone can help me, the Society for the Advancement of Judaism. Big name. When you think of the Society for the Advancement of Judaism, the synagogue gets honorary mention, but it's not the main platform. Herbert S. Goldstein, same idea, same concept. but it's always the synagogue that comes ahead of everything else. Mm-hmm. West Side Institutional, what's the last word? Synagogue. That was the name of the shul. Harlem Synagogue. The synagogue was always stressed. It was ahead of the ballpark. You had a pool, you had a soccer, you had a basketball court, whatever. You had meeting rooms, public lectures, but the synagogue was the most important part of the structure. And this is why, over the decades, people forget about Herbert S. Goldstein's role and give credit entirely to Mordechai Kaplan. It should be divided either 50-50 or 60-40. Give Mordechai Kaplan 60%. He was older. Now, how did this... Yeah?
Are you going to explain why Kaplan had this bias?
No, because it reflects the two different individuals. Yeah. Mordechai Kaplan goes on to become a class apikoros. All of Judaism is society for the advancement of Jews based upon the Jewish civilization. And Herbert S. Goldstein remains a very pious, frum yid, a member of Agudat Yisrael, Harry Fishel Institute, everything he's involved with. He's very, very different than Mordechai Kaplan.
In Jewish civilization, the shul is more important than basketball, even in Jewish
Well, yeah, but in the reality, to attract, the question is, what are you attracting, how you attract? You'll see.
Marketing.
It comes up even with Sidney. I'm going to show you even what Herbert Goldstein, but there was criticism of him. But you'll see. That's to be a reality. Yes, Yitzchak.
I think using the term civilization clouds the issue. The best term to use, really, is Mordechai Kaplan believed in the peoplehood and anything that contributed to the maintenance and
sustenance of the Jewish people.
So all the mitzvot, not because of God,
I understand.
Just like when you study about folkways in Asia or in South America. These are folkways that keep the people together.
Right.
In the synagogue.
Right.
Fine.
I agree with everything, but I'm only using Mordechai Kaplan's own words. Judaism as a civilization. And what you call... Well, all right. We're talking to a learned audience here. What you call a folkway, he called a civilization. But how did
he use the term folkway?
Say that...
He didn't want to use the word mitzvah.
I understand. That there's a commander. And he denied that there was anyone to command. Well, one of his students wrote a whole thing on how can you have mitzvot without commands. Listen, what came out of the society for the advancement of Judaism, guts a lot pit, you understand? So we don't have to go further.
And yet, there are people who have absolutely zero, and through that, they came up to Orthodox.
Okay, no. So what you're saying is something I'm going to deal with after class when I want to let off a little steam on my talk on Israel. I'm going to deal with Rabbi Riskin and deal with that in a second. But give it an hour. Let's come back here. Now, where did this thinking begin? Well, what happened? How suddenly? And here, it's very simple. And by the way, I'm very much, not that I'm in debt, I knew it, but it's still good to read a text and a structure. I'm very much in debt to the volume that I cited last week by Aaron Rachel, The Maverick Rabbi. It's his biography of his grandfather. And you see, when he comes to school, he's running the Talmud Torah. When all is said and done, Mordechai Kaplan's main responsibility is also getting involved with the youth. Rabbi Margolis is dealing with the elderly people, the middle-aged people, but you have two young JTS hotshots dealing with the youth. And what do you mean you're dealing with the youth? You walk into the shul. Let's walk into Kehilat Jeshurun, 1910, 1915. Beautiful shul. Luxury. The seats lined with velvet. Ein ani yud b'moka mashira. Fine. And you have plenty of balabatim there who are worth, by today's standards, billions of dollars, not just millions. No? Now you have a Talmud Torah. Would anyone venture a guess where the Talmud Torah was? In the basement of the synagogue. Not airy, not enough light. This is where the kids went to Hebrew school. Now, what message are you giving the kids? Yiddishkeit? Secondary importance. We'll give you an education. Where are we giving it? Not in the limelight, but in a dungeon. And both Kaplan and Goldstein came to the conclusion, this cannot go on. And by the way, in Kaplan's diary, you read about it too. Now, Herbert S. Goldstein and one of the Balabatim who absolutely agreed with him, Samuel Hyman, Samuel Balabas would say, I believe he's in the feather business. Yeah, you know what the feather business was? When pillows. Pillows are manufactured. They need feathers. Everyone needs a pillow. So it's quite that today everything is imported from China. But the feather business, I don't know if he was on the Lower East Side, on 7th Avenue, he did very well. And he was very upset. He was a frum Jew, very upset the way they're educating the kids. And they began a campaign to organize the Yorkville Talmud Torah. That's what it was called. In other words, not the Kehillat Jeshurun Talmud Torah, but that area of Manhattan is called Yorkville until today. Every area in Manhattan has a different name. Hell's Kitchen, right or wrong, that's one of the names. Yorkville, in other words, we're way beyond the limit of the synagogue. Any kid, we're going to build a beautiful, airy, beautiful building. And they decided that in that area, there are more than 5,600 children within a radius of 10 blocks. We're going to build an institute that's big enough that 2,000 children can be taught every day. Listen carefully. This institution will not merely be an ordinary Hebrew school, but also a Jewish social center, wherein they are provided a gymnasium, a room for club work, kindergarten classes, a kosher kitchen. In short, a center where the ideas of traditional Judaism will be fostered and encouraged in the minds of American youth. And this is where it all begins. And that building was built, that Talmud Torah was organized. Now, do you know where the building was? I'm going to introduce you to us. We're talking the mid-1915, they began 16, 17, that's when the building was built.
World War One is going on.
Yeah, this is World War One is going on, but it doesn't affect it. No, New York is blossoming. New York didn't get into the war till later, and these were years of money. There was money available. It's before the roaring 20s and the crash. You know where this building is? How many of you have ever been to Kehillat Jeshurun? What is adjacent? This is 86th Street between Lexington and Park. What is adjacent to Kehillat Jeshurun? It basically merges into one massive, beautiful building. I don't know how it was rebuilt. There was a fire there a few years ago. It's Raman's school, right or wrong. The famous Raman's school. That's the building that housed the Talmud Torah. This institutional Talmud Torah, this Yorkville Talmud Torah, morphs over the years into Ramaz. 20 years later, it's like the Jewish Center. Rabbi Young tried to organize the yeshiva, fell flat in his face. Organized the Talmud Torah, that Talmud Torah ultimately becomes a day school many years later. Manhattan Day School, MDS. Do I have it right, Charlie? Manhattan Day School? Okay. MDS. And this morphs into Ramaz. Now, how do I know I'm right? Because the Maverick Rabbi talks about the belief, and never gives you the exact address. All right, let me move sideways for a minute and give you a little bit insight. Why did the Rabbi Jacob Joseph experiment fall flat in his face? They brought to America a golden idea. They brought to America a Talmud Mufak of Reb Yaakov Yosef. Rebbeinu Shelolem, what happened to this man in America? Within a few years, he was totally demoralized, compromised, and it's such a sad story. And the answer is very simple, because in America you have no kahila, you have no structure. The people are free, they don't want a structure. America is the land of freedom, it's not England. England until today has an organized rabbinate, a chief rabbinate. South Africa has an organized rabbinate. Even in Australia there's an organized rabbinate. Canada, which should be like the others, but Canada is basically an American suburb. United States and Canada, freedom, who the heck needs organization, freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of religion. Now, do you know that before World War I and during World War I, till after, a little bit after World War I, an attempt was made to organize a kahila in the United States. A doctorate was done on this by Arnold Gorin, G-O-R-E-N, I don't know if he's alive yet, many years ago at Columbia U. It's called the Kahila of New York City. Very fascinating. They tried to organize the rabbinate, tried to organize kashrut, tried to organize shrita, tried to organize education of children, Talmud Torah, standards. It got absolutely nowhere because Am Kishei Orefu, and all of you know the Machloket, and if in the Torah world itself, until today, you have so much Machloket, how do you expect to have an organized Kehila, the Orthodox Shirabonim, the Hagen, and the Ein of the Andra? One is killing the other one, and in addition, you have Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionism. Now, what did come out of the Kehila is one gift. It's the only book I ever bought. I don't know if I had a bid for it. I have it in my library. It's over 100 years old and I still consult it. What did come out of the Kehila, when you have a Kehila, you have to know, Vic, what are we reading this Shabbos? Pashat Vamidbar, right or wrong? No, what's Vamidbar? What's Nasa about? How many Jews? How many Levites? You have to know who, when, where, right or wrong. By the way, let me move sideways again, tell you a good word from the Rav. Do you notice that even in America, Pashat Vamidbar will be read before Shavuot, by one day, right or wrong? So the Rav said, Minig Yisrael is makpid to read Vamidbar. You can't have Shavuot without reading Vamidbar. Why? Because what does a Jew say? Hey, he wakes up in the morning, I get so hard, who needs me, who cares, I'm only one, there's a world, there are millions, man. Who, what, when, where? Every Jew can do it. Every Jew is important. Every Jew counts. You, take a look at the census. You are all Makabel Torah, and every Jew can rise. The angel taught you Torah, just like he taught every other Jew Torah when you were in your mother's womb. It's a meritic vote from the Rav. So, come back here now. They had to do a census. They published a book. It's over 1,000 pages. It's called The Jewish Communal Register of New York City, 1917-1918. Well, you look in, Kehilat Jeshurun, address 117 East 85th Street. You look a little further, the Central Jewish Institute, 125 East 85th Street. Follow? It's adjacent. These buildings are big. They take up a few numbers, but adjacent to each other. And by the way, this communal register is invaluable. 1917, it gives you a picture. Congregation Hillel Jeshurun, Orthodox, organized 1890. Membership, 100. Seating capacity, 800. President, Moses H. Phillips. Rabbi, Moses S. Margolis. Now, what does that just tell you? Who's listed first? The president listed before the rabbi. Understand what it's telling you? Kehila. Who's important? And then, instead of giving you, and this is right down the line, instead of giving you a biography of the rabbi, right underneath Congregation Kehilat Jeshurun, Phillips, Moses, Hirsch, President, Kilat Jeshurun, since 1950, born 1846 in Russia, came to the United States in 1881. In other words, he was 35 years old, right or wrong, and received general Jewish education. It means he went to cheder, never graduated high school. Manufactures shirts. And boy, you can be sure he was successful. Residence, 40 East 83rd Street. The Central Jewish Institute, it describes it, a Jewish community center organized in 1916. Modern school building, 10 classrooms, 2 kindergarten rooms, 2 social rooms, library, auditorium, gymnasium, and it goes on and on, designed as a neighborhood center with an emphasis on Jewish educational work, building excellently equipped for educational, social, and recreational activities. Its Hebrew school gives instruction to 500 boys and girls, organize children's club work on the circle of Jewish children, work with adolescents through League of Jewish Youth. In addition to teachers and vice principal of the Talmud Torah, the Institute staff includes 10 paid workers and 10 trained workers who give part-time service free or at nominal rates. All right? You have a living description of what was going on in these two institutions and the Jewish Community Register. You have no idea how valuable that is. If you're familiar with my work, Washington, I give you the information on the shuls in the Bronx, the shul where I grew up, the shul that I went to, the shul I was bar mitzvah, and all the background material I got out of the Jewish Register. Invaluable. A good investment that I've had nachat from. Okay. So here.
Do you find any mistakes in there? It's a massive work.
Well, it's a massive work. There are bound to be mistakes, and there are bound to be people self-aggrandizement. But how can I find mistakes? Okay. In 1915, I wasn't around. The trick is to find someone who was alive, kicking, and knew what was going on 100 years ago, and let him look at the volume. But as far as I know, there's no one like that.
That means that this is considered a real good reference book.
Oh, yeah. It's an excellent reference book. You don't have nothing like it. It goes through every shul, and it gives you the president. And even to know who the president is, where he came from. You got a picture. Who were presidents of shuls? Balabatim, who couldn't speak English, or spoke a broken English. The native language was Yiddish.
No.
This is just New York. The Kehillah was put out by the Kehillah. There was some heavy reform money behind it who liked the idea of a Kehillah. And it got involved in it. If you read the work on fraud, holiness, and corruption, Gatzwitz's work on Kashrut in New York in this period, you'll see a lot of information coalesces with Gorin's work on the Kehillah. You follow? It's that same. Gatzwitz carries much more. You know who I'm talking about, right? It's a PhD from Columbia, also the same school.
What was
the
school. Interest of Columbia to have these?
And what's the interest of Columbia if you do a PhD on Mao Zedong's Tsetse Fly Circus? There was a guy in. MTA and Yeshiva College owed their existence to, you remember the name, Dean Sapphire. Okay, you know what his PhD was on in biology? The A reproduction of the tsetse fly. But this is scholarship. We used to make fun of him, and behind his back, the students, this is what he wrote about it. But this is life. This is scholarship. It's a contribution. No one knew about this before. People who can be cynical and say, who the heck's interested in Bernard Revel today? Who's interested in Shragai Feigl Mendelovich? Let someone do a proper doctorate on him. Follow? Wait till you see, as you know, Rakepit's new book, there's a bombshell there. Let's see who discovers, who explodes the bomb. It'll be interesting to see. Okay, but this This is what is germinating. This is what's happening. This is the great achievement of Ramaz, of his rabbinate, the people he brings in, and two young men from JTS. Now, while this is going on, Harry Fisher is Harry Fisher. He's the father-in-law. Being Harry Fisher's son-in-law works two ways. On one hand, you got to satisfy a man who's a great achiever, and he's a billionaire. And he's not going to be happy with his son-in-law who doesn't conquer the world. The other side of the coin, when your wife Rebecca is Harry Fischel's daughter, it gives you a little bit of independence. When I'm a young man in the rabbinate, when Yitz is a young man in the rabbinate, we had to make a living, right or wrong, Yitz. We had to think about money. We couldn't take wild steps. We were limited. We were fenced in. We had to cover our living. There was this before visa. I don't recall having a visa then. But you got to cover your expenses. So there's a plus and a minus to being a son-in-law of Harry Fisher. Evidently, and here it's only interpretation, you have to see what his grandson writes. I think I have my pulse on it as well. Gerbert Goldstein was a little bit unhappy in Kilat Jeshurun. He was the third in command. He's never going to rival Rabbi Margolis. He's ill at ease that Rabbi Margolis, that whole element in the synagogue is in Yiddish. He thinks in English. That whole element of the synagogue is yesterday. He's more concerned with tomorrow, with the youth. And you got to realize there's Mordechai Kaplan. And Mordechai Kaplan, coming from JTS, where until Mincha Goldstein came along, there was no formal Mincha. And you can sit down and eat and wash and not wash and make a bracha, not make a bracha. He was a little bit upset. This is the man I'm working with. Now, bear in mind, Mordechai Kaplan did not yet go public. It's going to be a few years later, 2 or 3 years later, when his parents both die. That's when Mordechai Kaplan goes public with his apikursis. But by 1916, 1917, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein makes the decision to move on, to go out on his own. People were shocked. 1917, he was a young man yet. He was doing wonderful things. He was accomplishing a great deal. But on second day Pesach, he got up, preached the sermon in English, and just as the Jews went through the Yam Suf, creating a point of no return, he announced to the congregation and read it word by word. Generally when he spoke from notes. This time, to be careful, declaring his intentions, reading it word by word, he announced that he's resigning from the Institute, the Talmud Torah, resigning from the synagogue, and he's going out on his own. Well, people accepted it, they understood, made him a big farewell dinner. And his wife, in her diary, describes the beautiful dinner and all the beautiful speeches. And then they come home, and there's a knock on their door, and a 10-year-old girl and a 7-year-old boy, a brother and sister, and they say, "What can we help you with?" They say, "Well, we came to see the rabbi." And the girl walks up to the rabbi And she says, I understand you're leaving the Institute, the Talmud Torah. I want to thank you. That's why my brother and I came. We're so happy in what you created, and we want to wish you much luck in your new work. And Rebecca writes that I considered that tribute to be greater than all the speeches of the board of directors of the Institute that were given at the dinner. And I think that's a beautiful, heartfelt description of where the officials were. I shouldn't say the officials, where the Goldsteins were, but you can understand that his wife was with him 100%. And that was very important. That's the son-in-law of Harry Fishel. Rebecca is with you. You're going out into an entire new world. Now, he didn't waste time. He chose Harlem. Why did he choose Harlem? Harlem, and there's all the sociological studies, you read about it. The Jew in the Gullus, at least, is always moving to a new area. Whether the Jew wants to move or doesn't want to move, there can be many factors why he has to move. The area changes. It's not like Mea Shearim or Geula or Rechavia, for that matter, which as time passes become more valuable and more valuable. It's very different than the Gola. So the wealthy Jews moved all the way up to the Upper East Side. Harlem was cheaper. Why was Harlem cheaper? Harlem was further away. Remember, you do have subways already. You have L's. But the heart of New York is 42nd Street. The heart of Jewish New York with all the businesses was the Lower East Side. So the Upper East Side was a drop closer. Harlem was further away. Harlem was cheaper. The masses moved to Harlem. Inevitably, Harlem became, for 80% of the Jews on the Lower East Side, the second area of their inhabitants. My parents, my four grandparents, Harlem. Harlem was it. Harlem was where the second yeshiva was organized. Besides the Lower East Side had IJJ and Eitz Chaim, Harlem is where Salanta was organized, just around this time as well. It's called the Salanta Talmud Torah. Later it morphs into Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yisrael Salanta. Later it goes to the Bronx, which becomes the third area that the Jews generally are moving to. So the fact that Harlem was filled with young Jewish families meant that there were endless children there. And Herbert S. Goldstein wants to influence these children. He has a dream. He is building a Jewish presence, an Orthodox presence, a Torah presence in the United States. And it's exactly what I said last week, quoting the Rav, and you can't understand what happened without understanding what the Rav said. And the Rav said when he came to America, he met many frum Jews and many fine Jews and Shema Mitzvot and people who sacrificed, but they had no vision for tomorrow. Their attitude was, we survived as Jews in America. There's nothing we can do to help our children. The children are lost. The grandchildren are lost. They raised their hands. There was no tomorrow. There was no heroic courage, to quote the Rav. Herbert S. Goldstein wouldn't give up. He had the vision of tomorrow. And as Vic Gelich said, he was the Steve Riskin of the 1910s, the Steve Riskin of the 1960s. He had that vision. Now, what you had in Harlem was a YMHA, Young Men's Hebrew Association. All this organized around Jewish welfare boards. You had it all over the United States. And Herbert S. Goldstein immediately took issue with the YMHA. Why? To quote him, it's simply copying a non-Jewish concept substitute the word Jewish for the word Catholic, but ultimately it
not
does
Catholic,
Christian, but ultimately it does little for the advancement of Judaism. There is no synagogue, there is no commitment, there is no Torah, there is no study. I'm quoting Rabbi Goldstein now. The synagogue failed to hold the youth, and instead of attempting to cure and remedy the existing evils within the synagogue, a new institution which did not cure the one spiritual ache, but brought on another pain, was created. These institutions, referring to the YMHA, are mainly negative in character. They do not represent any positive religious conviction. They are neither Orthodox nor Reform, neither fish nor fowl, and as a result produce men that have neither the historic faith nor the soul-saving message of the synagogue. Powerful. Absolutely honest. No, you say something honest, immediately you are attacked. Remember I quoted to you Rabbi Tal's position against, I gave out that pamphlet two weeks ago, against the bombardment, what's happening to our brains, being brainwashed by the new ethics, the new morals, the new world, the postmodernization. I didn't find one word in what he wrote that I don't sign on the dotted line. He has been attacked, not only the leftist, right, in so-called greater Mizrahi circles, Torah V'Avoda, Rabbi Stav Jr. I couldn't believe it. I have to read. I just got today, Rabbi Grinstein sent me a printout of Rabbi Stav's attack on him. Wow, they jumped on Rabbi Goldstein. How dare you talk this way about the wise? How dare you talk negatively? And he responded, what I insist on and say is that organizations like the YMNHA do not fulfill the spiritual vacancy or give the spiritual awakening which the young men and women of the day need. And he was right on. And he came up with the idea. And this is exactly paralleling, it's almost month by month with Mordechai Kaplan thinking in similar terms. He came up with the idea, we have to build a synagogue that has three components. The most important, the synagogue, the shul, the davening. Secondly, the YMHA component. In other words, YMHA and YWHA, young women, Hebrew. What's the last word?
Association.
And number three, the Hebrew school. And he spoke in terms, and he was absolutely right. He said, on a very pragmatic basis, it's going to be a lot cheaper for the community to run one institution which includes all three divisions. And this is absolutely right. You run a school, you run a shul, you run a community center. It's one building. You heat it. Today you heat it. You air condition it. You have one kitchen. It's a lot cheaper than having three separate buildings, three separate institutions. And this was his dream. And he organized it in Harlem, built it in Harlem, succeeded in Harlem, and had unbelievable influence on endless families. I've met people, Torah, Shomrei Torah in Mitzvot, and all due to Rabbi Goldstein's influence. Now, instead of a man belonging to three separate institutions, he could pay a little higher membership fee in the institutional synagogue, but that would include all the activities. The father and mother would go to the synagogue with their children. The young man and young woman would go to the building for social work. The children would go back to the Hebrew school, and they would thus be brought back to the family life, that religious unity and enthusiasm which is so sorely lacking today. And he went on and on. He admitted tremendous problems that Judaism faces in America. The greatest problem of all is a problem which, thank God, we don't have today. Work on Shabbat. 6.5-day work week. And he says we have to tackle that problem. We have to interest the manufacturers and laborers in a 5-day week. The second problem is one that we have all the more today. The environment around us. If the home is typically Jewish, the child will unconsciously absorb Judaism. But it has been the unfortunate experience of American Israel that young men and young women that come from good Orthodox traditional homes and yet do not remain Orthodox Jews. What is the reason? The chief reason is that when the young men and the young women leave their homes, enter into companionship with their friends, and spend social hours in institutions that are divorced from the influence of home, and the force of social life overpowered and overmastered the force of the home. And I don't have to tell you, these words are as true today as they were 100 years ago. And you heard Rabbi Willick, or if you heard the talk against with the whole question of Aliyah, so he mentioned the Israeli army. That's I couldn't believe, I don't even want to quote his words, that it's just so bad and so many kids becoming religious there. Listen, I don't know whether it's true or not. I think more kids become religious in the army than become irreligious, but that's a different story. But why is the army, why did we have that problem? Certainly in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, into the 80s, that good kids from good education, of course, it's a different environment. They're not prepared for it. This is why the army today is investing so much money in creating Haredi units, Dati units. We have tremendous problems in the army, because it's not just the army. It's the environment around us, women frontline soldiers, women equal to men, women exactly like men, women doing whatever men do. It goes against God's creation. It's impossible. And the army has found it out on certain levels. But these are real, real problems that when, and nothing has changed, 100 years later, you take a kid, can have the finest education, kid grows up in Givat Mordechai, kid goes to the finest schools, suddenly he's in a total alien environment. For the first time in his life, he's meeting kids who don't think like him, kids who are chiloniyim, kids who don't have the same values. This is a tremendous challenge. And this is why they developed here pre-army batei medrash, pre-army programs, pre-officer programs, no end to what's going on in innovativeness, hold on, to prepare kids for the challenge that is ahead of them. But I want to tell you, this is a double-edged sword. Just as the kid from Noam in Givat Mordechai for the first time meets all types of Chiloni Jews, a Chiloni Jew for the first time is meeting a Jewish kid. And you don't know what an influence that can have. I can tell you a story. I mean, I can tell you many stories, but tell you a real story that I've heard time and again from a very famous person. This person, Rubin, he was a Supreme Court judge. You know the name Rubinstein. So he told me when he was in the army, he met a soldier in his unit. And, you know, he'd a payasher. His parents spoke Yiddish to him. They're all children of survivors. And but they weren't religious anymore, traditional, but a breakdown in Shabbos, etc. And Rubinstein set the kid up with his cousin. And his cousin's parents told him off, how do you bring home a boy who's not religious? But the boy and girl hit it off, and they got married. Many years later, he's now the famous Attorney General of the country of Israel, is being driven around. He's coming from Tel Aviv. There was just a government meeting, and he's holding with him a black box that, in case of an emergency, has all the information in it, whatever has to happen. And he tells his driver, "I have Yotzer, I got to catch Minchen Itzkowitz in Bnei Brak." Goes in to, and he told me this story many times. He, evidently, his mind doesn't remember when he tells us. It happens to all of us. So he goes into Dap Mincha, and you know, Itzkowitz is every 2 minutes. It's probably the biggest minion factory in the world. It certainly is. And as he walks out, a guy with a long beard and payas is calling his name, waving, and he calls him over. He says, "Ma, Taloma Kiroti?" This was the guy he set up with his cousin. The guy from that they were mad at him, that they were in Shemesh Shabbos completely. This was the guy he set up with his cousin. So you see, you talk about the army, but the idea is to be machanech, that our children can go in and come out. And I have to give credit to the general in charge of the Haredi part of the army with all the new innovative programs. I think his name is Dubdavani. So Yehuda, so they interviewed him, and he said, "I judge my success if the Haredim who come into the army come out of the army the same Haredim 3 years later." I thought that was a fabulous, fabulous comment. Just think about it. Yes, Yitzchak.
I want to tell you, when I came to Israel, I was offered two jobs. One was to be a chaplain in the Israeli army, and the other was to be a chaplain in the Israeli police. I turned both of them down because I realized they were interested in one thing, a mezuzah on the door and kashrut in the kitchen. They were not interested in any programs for the boys. They went home on Shabbos. And having been an American chaplain in the army, I realized you have to, this is the last moment, it's misgeret, that you can reach an American Jewish kid. And all, he's all out of town, because right. He's all from somewhere else.
Right.
So emotionally, he needs a right. little friendship and social life. The chaplains in the Israeli army are false. They are only interested in mashkichim and being minyan, zogers. But they're not interested in educational programs.
Yeah, but Yitzchak, you're being a little too harsh. They invented a new modern word in Hebrew. You never heard this word in Bnei Akiva in America, neither did I. Hadata. You recognize the word?
No.
Charlie, do me a favor and get him a subscription to Haaretz. Should know what's going on here. Hadata. Okay, that's a new Hebrew word. You see what the word comes from, what the shorish is? Hadata. Dat. Trying to force religion down someone's mouth. In the army, the chaplaincy, if you call it the chaplaincy, it's not a real chaplaincy because the rabbinate here carries guns. We're fighters. We all have to carry guns. I was in the rabbinate and I carried a gun like everyone else. So if you start educating, no, you're not there for that. You're there to provide services to the individual religious soldier and to the general atmosphere in the army. This is what makes conversion easier here, because 90% of the people living here don't eat chametz on Pesach. You follow? 90% of the people living here light Hanukkah candles. So there has to be a certain atmosphere that it's a Jewish army, but don't overdo it. So the rabbinate has certain limitations. Aseret Yemei Tshuva, they do go out and speak in every base in the country. You have to give credit to keep all the bases kosher, the kasher for Pesach. You have to give credit. On the other hand, you have Kamela Menashe. You know who Kamela Menashe is, at least? Okay, Baruch Hashem. So one time there was a group at the Kotel, they just finished basic, they had a ceremony, or they were coming back from the hike before they swear in, and they met a Rav, a big Rav, maybe it was Rav Reuven Elbaz, could be. And some of the Sephardic soldiers recognized him and said, "Come, we'll get a bracha." And everyone went over to him and he gave them a beautiful bracha. Do you know that the next day she was ranting and raving on the radio that soldiers were forced to go to a bracha by Rav Reuven Elbaz? All right, the army investigated and laughed at it. But that's what we're up against. So please, I would have said, I, Yitzchak Reuven, came in Aliyah. I was offered two jobs. I didn't take them because my Hebrew is not up to the average Sabra. I don't know their mentality. I was a little hesitant. Let me tell you a story, okay? Rakefet came in Aliyah, 69. I had a job. I had a contract. I signed it. I was offered the job on Tanya Tester, 1969. I signed the contract on Purim. It's for the encyclopedia. The story was that the encyclopedia originally was a government project. They got money from Germany, reparations, because the Judaica was stopped by Hitler. You know what I'm talking about. 7 volumes came out in German. Now do it all in English. The government... All right, Kolzmann was a government project. You know your Yiddish, ich kum heint, ich kum morgen. No one gives a hoot. Then they sold off to a consortium from Australia, headed by Yitzhak Rishon. He hired me. Ah, they want to see results. So he saw that an idiot in America wants to come in Aliyah. The dummy, you know, they interviewed me and I had to give all my statistics. Hey, wait a minute. Here's a guy, a Rav, a PA, a doctorate, and a contract for a book with JPS. I get a telegram. He's coming to America to interview me. Not just me. Obviously, there were others too. All right? He offers me the job. All right. Now, I come in Aliyah. I meet some people here. Let the man remain nameless. Zichrono Levracha. He offers me a full-time teaching job in a college. I say, how can I take the job? I signed the contract. He says, no, in Israel we break contracts. I was too American. I said, I can't do that. These people... 2 years went by. And now, the encyclopedia is out. The publishing house comes to me and offers me 2,000 lira a month. That was a real salary. If I would become a staff editor of Keter. Keter now bought them out. They're the ones. I said, no, I can't do it. I have to go back to teaching. So now I want to find a teaching job. The guy who offered me the full-time job now offers me like half a job. The BMT already, I was teaching part-time from 69, now Gold got in. So I was building up to a full job, and then a high school, a very prominent high school with a very top educator, Himmelfarb, turned to me, oh, we heard you're looking for teaching. There's nothing we would love better. They offered me on the table, under the table, come in and teach Gemara. We're looking for a Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik. And I turned them down. And you know why the main reason I turned them down? Because I know enough about high school kid mentality in the United States, seniors to give me the senior degree, this class, that class. I would have fallen flat in my face and made a Major League Baseball player hitting 197 look like a star. Got it? So that's what you should have said. Don't get excited about the Rabbinet. They do great work. My dear students,
chaplains in the army.
Well, excuse me?
Their conception of a chaplain is totally different
than America because of the circumstances. In America, you don't have to answer to Haddatah and to the and to Avigdor Lieberman. I've got to tell you.
You can't just come in and push people. I can look for example in the chapel that I had. I couldn't put in the mechitza.
Okay, I understand. That's part of life. Okay, now, 1 second. Well, so now you'll ask yourself a question. If this is his innovation, and this is...
When you said there were three problems. One was 6 day week.
No, there were two problems. And one was the influence, the outside influence. And his dream was that the 6 day week will solve, and that he worked on in the OU and the Sabbath Commission, that perhaps is starting to be solved in the late 1910s, early 1920s. But the outside environment, and there it's only if the synagogue is at the base, but we have the YMHA and the institutional Talmud Torah, perhaps then we'll be able to overcome the outside environment.
Now, what I'd like to say, if I want to my father-in-law, Rabbi Philip Goodman.
Right.
He was with Rabbi Goldstein.
Right.
When he went to Harlem, when he left Harlem, Rabbi Goldstein, he went to the Institutional Synagogue in the West Side. He remained the rabbi till it closed.
Right.
The
in Harlem.
Later, he went to JWB.
Right.
Everything you're describing, he worked, and which was difficult.
Right.
Because the Reform people there were really powerful.
Right, right,
he introduced Jewish content into the work of YMHS.
Right.
So he started to write pamphlets.
Right, 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 which led to his books.
That's how it became books.
Right.
But this was a very strong influence.
Right.
All of a sudden there were pamphlets introducing Pesach into your program.
Right, right.
Introducing Sukkot.
Right.
So it became, it was bitter of it.
Right, right. No, you are. You're fighting the whole powerful Reform movement here. And this is why you got to give credit to people like Goldstein or Goodman and you take Young. They went out on their own and they took on the crowd. And Rabbi Goldstein succeeded. The institutional synagogue became a Shem Dover. It captivated the masses. Endless youth became Shomer Torah mitzvot because of him. And even Mordechai Kaplan had to admit that there's a tremendous difference between my idea and between what Goldstein is doing. The institutional synagogue was a religious why, I'm quoting Kaplan now, whereas my Jewish center was to have the synagogue itself for worship, but everything else an addendum, and there was little connection between everything else that went on and the basic synagogue. And this was Herbert Goldstein's greatest achievement. He refused to change the name. People bothered him. Why, ultimately, West Side Institutional Synagogue? Why not Jewish Institutional? Why not call it an Orthodox YMHA? Why did he insist on having the word synagogue? But this was his concept. The heart of it had to be a synagogue. Hold on for 1 second. I just want to show you something. There was one part of all this that Reichel struggles with, and this too, if there's any research that can be done. Here we're talking about a strictly Orthodox institution, a man with total commitment, and yet when he writes about the institutional synagogue, where the young folk, I'm quoting now from Goldstein, might attend the gym, do social work, or study, or run a dance. And you had dances all over the Orthodox synagogues in New York. As I mentioned to you last week or the week before when we dealt with Minhagim, and we used as an example Rabbi Avishai David. If you recall, his mother met his father at a social dance run by the Young Israel. And here you have it. There are other parts, too, in the Maverick Rabbi, where he has to deal with it. How could his father allow it? I think the ultimate answer is a concept in Chazal. Luke, help me out. Tov sheyiyu shogegin v'yaliyu meizidin. That when something is not mentioned explicitly in the Torah, we always go with the viewpoint, better they should do it in ignorance. And how would you translate shogegin? Better they shouldn't do it with conscious feeling. Better they shouldn't do it with a feeling of transgression. Let them be shogegin. Let them not be mezitin. It's a very interesting question. How did all these synagogues have social dancing? You can understand it. The outside influence. How do you meet anyone? If you go to the movies and watch movies or go on YouTube and you watch movies out of the 1940s, out of the 1950s, I guarantee you, if you do research, the greatest vehicle for boys and girls to meet each other was at dances. Right or wrong? Ramaz, when my wife went to Ramaz, they ran dances. One time in Brookline, we got to ask Yitzhak, but it was in his time in the school, they wanted to introduce social dancing. The kids should know how to do social dancing. It was so ingrained in the mentality that people didn't realize that this is not within the consonance of Torah existence, Torah lifestyle. But it's interesting that even here with Herbert S. Goldstein, with all the frumkeit in the world, here you see an exact quote, and one of the avenues of activities, social dancing within the institutional synagogue. Not just there, it's elsewhere. It begs research and see if anyone can come up with a better reason than the reason I just offered, Tavshi Shogi Nevalu Mei Zidin, which may or may not apply. I don't want to go into Lamdanut, but it could be that the pshat is, if it's a dindi or writer, you never say Tavshi Shogi, and even if it's not written explicitly. If it's a dindi rabbanon, that's where you say Tavshi Shogi. Now you got to get involved. Social dancing, is it the oraita or the rabbanon? So machlokes rishonim, look into the Rambam, Hilchot Isuri Bia, Lo Tikrav, it's an isa de oraita. Look into the Ramban and others, it's only an isa de rabbanon. Isha benida tumato, Lo Tikrav. Lo Tikrav means relations, sexual, but it doesn't mean just physical. That's an isa de rabbanon, obviously. So it's a whole machlokes haposkim. Did the Rabbanim think in these terms? I don't know if there was that much lumdus floating around America 100 years ago, but it was a reality due to the social pressure. So that's one question that hangs fire. Yes, yes, Morty.
How did he fund his institution?
Well, his father-in-law played a role, but when you had the masses, you can put it all together. He did it. He held it. He did it. On the Upper West Side, when ultimately he moves, and I can give you the, I think it's 37 when they officially move and leave Harlem in the hands of Rabbi Goldstein. Yeah, 1937. I know I wrote it down. 1937, they officially moved. On the Upper West Side already had wealthier Balabatim. There already he was more financially secure. For Haraya, whenever people came to raise money for Europe or Palestine, one of their main stops was Seth Side Institutional Synagogue. Yitzchak, we have a question to ask you. Was there social dancing in Maimonides in your time? They want to introduce, to teach the boys, the girls, how to have social graces. That's before your time, after your
Never
time?
Had
Never had it. Okay.
I was there from 1940 to 1956.
So then it never was, because someone told me there was once talk of doing it, but here you see in Rabbi Goldstein's...
These are called rumors.
No, I understand. Okay, yes, Charlie?
Rabbi Goldstein didn't leave anything in writing on social dancing?
No. He didn't. If he left in writing, we would solve the problem very easily. But he evidently had to accept what was going on in every second young Israel, if not every young Israel. It was a total breakdown in that area where at least the boys and girls should meet. Listen, I can give it to you in different contexts. The dean's reception. We have to end off. I want to say a few other words. The dean's reception. You know what I'm talking about? In YU, the minhag was, the nohag was, that the end of your junior year, the dean had a reception for you, that you've survived 3 years, you're now going into your senior year. The senior year was always easier in the sense no one was going to be kicked out their senior year. So you brought your girlfriend or a date to the dean's reception. Well, machloket broke out after World War II, and to World War II, this was taken Kribe Rafu. You know, it's axiomatic. What's wrong? They're old enough to get married. They're old enough to date seriously. After World War II, so this is when Chaim Dov Keller, if you recall, Rabbi Keller was Normie Lamb's roommate. They slept in the same room. He finished 3 years in Yeshiva College, and over the dean's reception, he slammed the door, walked out, and he went on to become Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller, Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah of Agudat Yisrael, Chicago Tells, Rosh Yeshiva, critique par excellence of Normie Lamb. In my time, the machloket broke out again. And I still see in front of my eyes the Rav and Rav Mendel Zaks fighting it out, yelling at each other, right outside Dr. Belkin's office on the first floor of the yeshiva. And there's Rav Yeruchim Gerelik pitching in, and we were kids listening. And the Rav's attitude was, Vasas Besas, his own treffen up gas, or they own treffen in the yeshiva. What's better, they should meet on the streets or meet with the sanctity of the yeshiva? See, that was the Rav's position. So I'm not making an analogy to social dancing, but it could be that they inherited a situation that if we want the boys and girls to marry Jewish and meet Jewish people and meet in the synagogue, the only way to attract them is by having a social dance. And Malka tells me, in her time in Ramaz, they were teaching the girls how to dance, how to have social grace. This was part of the curriculum, teaching the boys. Today, I doubt if they do it in Ramaz. I hope not. How to dance when you're playing music. Different, good dancing. Baruch Hashem. But this was the reality. All right, we have basically one more step to go with Rabbi Goldstein, and from there we'll move on to Rabbi Lookstein, and from there we'll move on into next year. I can't believe it, but we're hitting June and all that goes with it.
Just one thing. Talking about the Upper East Side or the Upper West Side, describing the West Side Institutional Synagogue, or on the other hand, the Jewish Center, and then going downtown, the Lower East Side, where the Young Israel Movement
began. Concomitantly.
Concomitantly for sure. And though there were a lot of parallels, there were a lot of differences, both from a financial and physical point of view, because of resources apparently.
The Young Israel needs a definitive study. We've yet to have a definitive study. But Young Israel, the scope of Young Israel is much more limited. In other words, Young Israel, it was not a full-time concept of boys and girls. It was a concept of a shul that will speak to the new generation. Young Israel grew in with Talmud Torah and with the 40s into the 50s. You're talking in Israel adult education. But in the 1910s, Young Israel centered around a dignified service with no talking and with English instead of Yiddish. That was the heart of it.
And also youth participation.
Yeah, no, I understand. But you didn't speak in terms of a Talmud Torah, of a school, of a YMCA. This was a Jewish center. It was very different.
And
Young Israel was founded by students, essentially. JTS students were the heart of it. And they were busy studying. They couldn't take on full-time rabbinic. Afterwards, it's an amazing story, Young Israel, where it was and where it's at. Okay, so to reiterate, I wanted to tell him the term was the Society for the Advancement of Judaism. I asked him this morning what Mordechai Kaplan called his shul. I remember it had a long, fancy name. But notice not the word synagogue in it. And Herbert Goldstein, West Side Institutional Synagogue, underlined synagogue. So two men deserve the credit for the concept of a Jewish center. Each one went on a different path, but the Jewish center got off the floor. Rabbi Young's Jewish center, Mordechai Kaplan's Jewish center, and Herbert Goldstein's Jewish center.
I wonder if Jonathan Sada and his book, American Judaism, makes the same point.
I'll take a look. I have to look. It's worth looking at.
It's interesting that he didn't write it. Anita Livingston, Medicine, wrote about the history of Jews in America, two volumes.
Right.
But he, and Grinstein wrote about New York. But he, he writes American Judaism. It's more a sociological study rather than just...
Right, no, he's more on a sociological level. That's what the study's about. But I want to look at it. There's Marshall Sklar wrote 1950s on conservative Judaism, very fascinating volume, but his predictions turned out to be all wrong. If you remember the book, it was the conservative movement will conquer everything, orthodoxy will ultimately disappear. That was the underlying conclusion.
Is there any contribution of Gulag to American Judaism?
Gorg has written very nice works on accommodators and resistors. He wrote on Mordechai Kaplan with J.J. Schachter. He wrote on Why You Student Body. Very fine work, very fine individual. Baruch Hashem. First of all, I have to tell you, this brings joy to my heart, because the Haredi world is going to have the same problems we have. It has them already. And yesterday, you know, in class, how much hatred was expressed here by Rabbi Rubin and some others against the Haredi world. And I got home and all I heard in the radio was the maledictions of the Haredi world, Avigdor Liebman, second to none, what's going on. By the way, there are rumors today that he's going to run with Ayelet Shaked, run one ticket together. It's unbelievable what Israeli...
She denied it.
Deny from today to tomorrow. Let's see when push comes to shove what's on the line. It's amazing what the Jewish mind can come up with. I give credit to... We all learned Gemara in our youth, it seems. Even Ayelet Shaked, the Malach Torah, so si fashteit ganz gut, a sugya, hina, her, we punish a item. The South Koreans are right. We are very brilliant people because we learned Gemara. So this article appeared in the magazine section of Yisrael Hayom a week ago. Echad Miyodat. And it's on, I checked it out who these people are. I got a good report. It's on Haredi women of mother and two daughters, all Beis Yaakov graduates, who want to learn Gemara. And they've organized, they're all married, families good, they've organized a regular Beis Medrash, they're now raising funds to institutionalize it. So I want to make a little prediction. What's the greatest problem we struggle with? Rakepa gets hit every other day. Women rabbis, Rebbe, a woman can be, your own dermatologist is your own female student, right? Correct? So why can't a woman who knows Shas and Pais can be a rabbi? 20 years from now, and it takes 20 years, 15 years to germinate, the great Haredi world will have exactly the problems we have. There's now a Haredi woman in the Knesset, Kachol Lavan, right or wrong, and you know how much that woman, she could save Torah in our time, she's being told. If she would jump over to the Likud, Netanyahu would have a government of 61. He would tell the Liebman to go fly a kite. You know, the pressure being put on her? Be like Esther Hamalka. I'm being serious now. She's being told this by, not by Rakefet, by Gedolei Yisrael. And Zi Halzich Bagan studies the Gadol Hadar. Shem, boy, oh boy. The Haredi world is coming out of the ghetto. Yitzchak, give it a chance. Don't maledict them. They're our best friends. And you heard what I told you about the Satmar. Morty doesn't know it. Some Satmar from Brooklyn came to visit Israel first time. They went to Kiryat Arba. You heard what happened? And they're walking along. Then they see a soldier with his gun and the works and with a burden payers. Start talking with him. He introduces them one Shomer Shabbos after another. We can't believe they never, you know, they were taught every soldier's an ice bath. They bought them all pizza. Now I got to tell you how I get shot. In my back. And if you recall my talk on Israel and answering and taking a different point of view than my dear colleagues, rabbis Willick and Schechter. Willick first, because he spoke more, and Rabbi Schechter was more quiet. So I used the example, remember I asked Charlie to meet me at 69th Street and Amsterdam Avenue, and I used the example of Riskin there and Riskin here. And it played well, I have to tell you, even in Washington Heights, I've gotten a lot of nice emails, and I thank the people. One person wrote to me, "We dafka listen to you because there's avira diara when you speak." You know, who else can speak about the army, about the Mossad? All right, Baruch Hashem. But Riskin undermines me. This appeared in the weekend news section of Yisrael Hayom, an interview with Rabbi Steve Riskin. I want to go on record that I disagree with every word here in the article. The first thing I disagree with, there are two main issues. The first part, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. Steve can be right. I have a right to disagree. He has a right to his opinion. That's reforming conservative. How do we treat them? Is it better they didn't exist or better they do exist? So you heard Rabbi Rubin just told you that because someone went to Reconstruction today, they're an Orthodox Jew. I take the point of view that they've harmed more. If they didn't exist, many more Jews would come back to Yiddishkeit. But I told you my own experience. These people say to me, "Our rabbi says we can drive to shul," and I got nowhere. But maybe Riskin's right. Could be I'm wrong. The second part of the article, I can't believe that we should build a conservative temple at the Kotel HaMaravi. And I don't understand it like that lady who wrote that beautiful book about learning through Shas, and she boasts that she reads the Davening on Yom Kippur, reads the Torah every Shabbos. What do you do with so many Gemaras? What do you do? The whole concept of a Mechitza begins at the Kotel HaMaravi. The Gemara in Sukkah, I don't understand Rabbi Riskin. But why? Why? So I totally differ. But why am I saying this? Because I don't want anyone to shoot me down. Take a look. Rakefit spoke about Israel. How wonderful. Who does he quote? Rabbi Riskin. Rabbi Riskin did great things. You can't take away what he did accomplish. And Rabbi Riskin, and I'll tell you something else which you should know and appreciate. Rabbi Riskin in America fell flat in his face when Rabbi Back died suddenly. You know what I'm talking about? Rabbi Pincus Beck. Let me pronounce the name right. Bach. His father was a big Talmud Chacham, Talmud of the Rav. Rav in Baltimore wrote a sefer in memory of his son afterwards. He was Rabbi Riskin's right hand. He was fabulous. And here Rabbi Riskin is building a high school for boys, high school for girls. Why you were shaking? And the Rav went to speak for Rabbi Riskin, the famous talk that I recreated and did in the Kollel about 30 years ago. And I quoted in the Rav's words, redoing that talk. What a talk. The Rav gave in Riskin's shoe. Why you were shaking? And suddenly dancing on Purim with a whole group of students, Rabbi Back has a heart attack and dies. Almost no one from that class remained normal. You can go one by one. The class of 1974, whatever year it was revisited, you have no idea what came out of that class. Everyone paid a price to see your beloved Rebbe die before your eyes. Riskin could never replace him. And ultimately, when he went on Aliyah, his shul was thriving, but the other institutions were history. Here in Israel, there's a tremendous blessing. There are so many good people in Chinuch, and every year there are more and more. And it's been honed, it's been fine-tuned, that Rabbi Riskin has fabulous people working in all his schools. I'll go even further. Rabbi Hartman, David Hartman, and all of you know Labriyut, I'm a big fan of David Hartman of 1954, and a big detractor of David Hartman of 2024. We'll get there. But his school left two high schools. Very interesting. I know kids, my grandchildren know them, and they've been kids of Frum. And he runs a school. You're not forced to daven. Davening is voluntary. There's some kids that need that. It's an amazing thing. They have good machanchim, good people. They're from kids. I've seen kids come out of Hartman. I've seen girls, all right? They daven. The girls daven three times a day. They learn Gemara. They want to learn Gemara. We have to deal with this. But the commitment is there. So this is Israel. So please don't shoot me down because I used Rabbi Riskin as my example. Gentlemen, this is Motzash, Maparishon. And here's a family celebrating that their, what are they celebrating? 70th birthday of their grandmother Evelyn, whom they love. And among the celebrators, the celebrants, if I'm more correct, Ranana the Eli Carrigan, Petach Tikva. How does that relate to you, Morty?
He's my double first cousin's grandson.
Pass that back to Morty. Don't confuse us, double first cousin's grandson. Orthodox Union Inspiration, two copies, Herman Wouk, talking about how Rabbi Young got him involved in This Is My God. Herman Wouk, commentary, very interesting. The editor of the commentary apologizes that his father totally would criticize Herman Wouk. Beautiful, beautiful article. Those of you that have feeling for Lubavitch, for Chassidus, and again, some people took Chassidus and ruled them out of Yiddishkeit. I can't do that. Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. But if the world, I got one student drove me crazy, I told you, from America, he doesn't want his kids to go to a bonfire, it's up because there's a big machlokes, by the way, in Lakewood now. So I told him one thing in Israel that everyone does from Bnei Akiva to Turi Kates, they make a fire on Leil HaTzmut. You claim it's a Avodah Zarah, and I tell you, Klal Yisrael was machshirit. I don't know. So this machlokes lives on. Anyway, this is the Lubav, the sixth Rebbe went to Lakewood when he came to America. And there was a wealthy Lubavitcher living in Lakewood, had a little hotel. They wanted the Rebbe to remain there. So these are pictures from the Rebbe in Lakewood. Danny Danone, Israel's representative to the UN, gets the Rakefet reward for speaking the truth. For the first time since Chaim Herzog, someone got up in the UN, put a kippah on his head, and read from the Bible who Eretz Yisrael belongs to. Kol HaKavod. This is a beautiful story of a woman. When someone from, this was in Brazil, they came to the home of the Chabad Shluchim and asked if they'd be interviewed, and they weren't so anxious, but all right, it's the television, they were interviewed, and they were asked the question, how many children do you have? And they said, 9. And they said, why have such a large family? And the lady answered, every child is a present from God. We are joyous at every gift God gives us. A decade later, a woman came to the rabbi and said, I owe you my life. It turned out that this girl, her mother was pregnant with her, and she was ready to do an abortion. And she heard the interview with the Chabad couple, and the mother decided not to do an abortion. And the girl came to the rabbi, I owe you my life. This, I got to give Shuli Berger credit of YU, my student, head of the archives. She just published a piece. It's 100 years since my cousin Rabbi Revel led the first Chag HaSlicha in Yeshiva's history. 100 years, 1919. She quotes me. It's a very nice piece. One second. Yeah, this is on Sempo Sugihara. His son has been speaking, and he's the story that he was writing visas on the train. He said it's not true. He tried to make his father a more human being than an angel. I don't know if it's true or not true. He admitted that some he did write. Why and what? But Baruch Hashem, it's an interesting article about his father. This is open to debate. The new RCA Siddur put out here by Corin, it has a lot of compromise with the feminist movement, and a lot of people claim the Rav would not be happy with this Siddur. reach your own conclusion. This is on Simple Sugihara, the same article, interesting pictures. He appeared at Limud over the world. He speaks Hebrew. This is why you, the Machloket goes on. It has never been solved. The vice president who's leading, they don't give his name, is very upset with Voloshin Yeshiva. Shut it down. Get rid of it. You know what I'm talking about? The Voloshin Yeshiva, that they, it's a branch within YU. They call themselves the Voloshin Yeshiva. They want to get rid of all the courses in YU that teach Akbi courses. And the Machloket has been going on since 1928. We still can't solve it. So I have a lot to say on the topic, but leave it for another time, obviously. In the Museum of the City of New York, when you go back, there's now a whole display on the Jewish role in the trade unions, the big fire in New York, the girls who work in the sweatshops, and all the Jews that played a role in creating the unions. Three fires in the Boston area at Chabad houses, anti-Semitism was on, police investigating. Here is the pictures from Lakewood of the Rebbe, and they put a fortune of money in, and they were able to polish up some of the pictures. It's much, much clearer than the original. That's the Rebbe, and that's Rabbi Waxman. That's Chaim Waxman's father, Rabbi Nissen Waxman, the clean-shaven rabbi, who was rabbi in Lakewood and brought the Lubavitcher there, wanted him to stay, and then brought Rabbaron Cutler, Morty, to Lakewood. It's amazing what comes out. Here is Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky, one of the Chabad leaders being interviewed at Truro College. Endless pictures, Rabbi Kadish, the president of Truro College, talking with him. Here is Torah writing in D.C., again, only Chabad can pull this off. They're writing a Sefer Torah, and at the conclusion of the Torah, here is two Supreme Court justices looking on. One of them is Ilana Kagan, who is the first lady to be bat mitzvahed by Rabbi Riskin at Lincoln Jewish Center, a Supreme Court justice today. Here is another rupture in the Haredi world. Yehudis, the Tzduki, the Sadducee, a girl from Stanford Hill who started learning Gemara. And let me tell you, Vic, in Stanford Hill, I would advise girls not to learn Gemara. You want to learn Gemara, move to Hendon or to Golders Green, not Stanford Hill. There's Poway, the tragedy. Rabbi Goldstein is being cared for by the surgeon. Nine fingers are still in bandage. One finger is gone. He found out the doctor, Dr. Yael Kadetsky, a plastic surgeon, is Jewish, and he had never put tefillin on. He put tefillin on him. Unbelievable. This is abortion, what's going on. What is the Jewish stand on abortion with everything going on in America? And we have a nuanced stand, because it's not that we outlaw abortion. We outlaw abortion when it's not permitted halachically. Very, very interesting. And finally, I can't believe this, but if it's right on with our lecture, HaTorah Chozeret al Achsanya Shalah, would you believe it or not, in Harlem, there now is Jewish food festivals, Shabbat Friday night dinners, glatt kosher, top chefs, Jews moving back to Harlem. Boy, we need a Rabbi Goldstein to come back to life. And how I can't get rid of Mishpacha. Yitz is good enough to bring it in for me. My wife reads it. I look at it. I offer it here for nothing. A recent issue of Mishpacha, all about a Shemesh Shabbos tzaddik, a surgeon. They put a new face on a girl, on a woman whose face was demolished from Cleveland. I offer it, and I offer it again. My dear students, until we meet again in health and happiness next week, no class on Sunday. Enjoy Yom Yerushalayim. Final class on Monday. The week afterwards is Shavuot, and the Rebbe, right after Shavuot, puts a mask on his face. He is breathing Greater New York Air. I have to get my lectures ready, the trip ready, fighting a battle. The book should be printed in time, signed off with all the corrections yesterday. I still have to see the pages one more time to see that the corrections are in. The Eibishter should give strength. Guests coming from America, Shavuot, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. God gives strength. May I call Rabbi Yelin Levine for the Nachas Daf Min Chatan Keach. When will the book be published? With Mazel, it'll be published in June, but it all depends. It's being indexed now. I don't know how long that'll take. It's well over 300 pages. Indexing is a job. Until we meet again in health and happiness, and with a thank you for Yomo for setting up the microphone, Das Vedanya. Everything up for grabs. Help yourself.